The name of this lecture is Psychotropic Drugs and Biblical Counseling. Some of the things that you may be wondering about medicines we'll be exploring in more detail in this talk. I want to start with a quote from Will Medicine Stop the Pain? Painful feelings are meant to motivate us to change. When a medicine masks painful feelings, there's no motivation to learn to deal with them in a more godly way. And when the medicine is discontinued, predictably, the painful feelings will return. So we are going to, in this message, start out by talking a little bit about medicines. Please don't scrawl everything that I say about the medicines. As we talk about the medicines, I'm really just intending to give you a sense for how serious and the scope of the medicines. To really understand all of this, you really kind of need a medical education, okay? And I'm not trying to turn you into young doctors. So just really do yourself a favor and let it wash over you. If you want it in hard copy, Craig gave everyone from my group a PDF of the PowerPoints. I'm sure that he can make that happen for these last four talks for those of you who didn't get it because you're not in the rest of my course. But try to just listen and learn from it, okay? Then we're going to be talking about drug dependence and withdrawal, the becoming used to being on the medicine, it losing its effectiveness, and the problem that I call therapeutic tail chasing, which is having a person develop side effects from a medicine that's misidentified as a new disease, resulting in the prescribing of more drugs. Then we're going to be talking more about antidepressant violence and suicide. You've already heard my testimony, but I'm going to be talking about why certain smart people think it happens. Then we're going to be talking about side effects, and then once again, ask ourselves, can medicines help in the light of all these things? So we're going to start with what medicines are given. Medicines that are given for emotional pain, and this is an overview slide. I'm going to break this down with each section. There are two basic categories that I see, and I'm kind of more a lumper than a splitter, so bear with me if you don't see it the same way. There are drugs that improve feelings, and there are drugs that clear confused thinking. By confused thinking, I mean people who have psychosis, who aren't thinking clearly because they're having hallucinations, for example. Okay? Subcategories of the drugs that improve feelings include drugs that induce relaxation and antidepressants. Drugs that induce relaxation, you may be surprised to see that I put pain medicines, alcohol, and street drugs in there with tranquilizers. As we'll find, they all work basically the same way. They work on the same receptors in the brain. And then there are antidepressants. You know about those already. The drugs that clear confused thinking include antipsychotics and mood stabilizers. We'll be talking about those more later. But let's start with drugs that improve feelings. I hope that's readable for you. The fonts that I use on my Mac often don't come across exactly the same when it's displayed on a PC, but I hope you can see what it's saying. All the medicines that we're going to discuss in this group of medicines that improve feelings without changing the way the counselee is responding to their environment. So we all have habitual patterns of response. The medicines don't change those. They simply change the way we feel. Therefore, the medicines produce a mood that doesn't match the counselee's situation. So to not be depressed when your child has run away from home and your husband's lost his job and you have a life-threatening illness, if you were depressed before and you go on the medicines and you're no longer depressed but your thinking is still the same, it doesn't match, does it? It doesn't match up with the circumstances. We call that having a mood that's incongruent with your real life circumstances. So this group of drugs that improve feelings, again, includes the drugs that induce relaxation and antidepressants. So first we're going to talk about the drugs that induce relaxation. Many of the substances that we have experienced that induce relaxation are not usually used as psychiatric medicines. These include medicines for serious pain. I'm not talking about Tylenol or even Celebrex or Naproxen. I'm talking about medicines for serious pain, like OxyContin, Percocet, Vicodin. Okay? Induces relaxation as a side effect. Street drugs make people relaxed. Alcohol make people more relaxed. And then there are tranquilizers. We're going to talk about each one. But before we do that, let's make note of the fact that medicines for physical pain are often received by people who are experiencing emotional pain. Not because the doctor sits down and says, I think I'll give OxyContin to this person who's struggling with their emotions. But because people who are experiencing pain are often also depressed or anxious. And those who are depressed or anxious experience pain more severely than those who are not. So physical pain and emotional pain commonly occur together, and pain medicine is commonly given when both are present. Now, you can see how this could lead to be a problem, how I might confuse, and I have. I had serious pain at one point in my life, and there's a real problem with confusing your physical pain and your emotional issues. It requires much wisdom. I'll be talking more about that in a minute. How do pain medicines work? They work by decreasing awareness of pain in the brain. Now, I'm talking now about pain medicines. I'm not talking about alcohol and street drugs. They work by decreasing awareness of pain in the brain, not in the part that's sore. And this produces relaxation as an unintended effect, a side effect. If we could come up with a pain medicine that produced pain relief without relaxation, now that would be a great drug. Because people do get confused in their drug use when they have pain and they also have things going on in their emotions. Relaxation can also induce confusion, though, which can trigger or worsen depression and anxiety, causing someone who's a pain sufferer to also begin struggling with depression and anxiety that they didn't experience before as a result of the pain medicines that they're taking. Then the relaxing pain, effects of pain medicine is very pleasant. Many people find it difficult to resist, which is one of the reasons why addiction happens not just in people who are looking to get high, but in people who are serious Christians who have emotional issues that amplify their physical pain and physical pain that amplifies their emotional response. So I'm not pointing any fingers at anyone who becomes addicted to pain medicines, although once people are addicted, they tend to choose sins to maintain their supply of the medicine. So anything can become contaminated by sin. But very commonly, people who become addicted to their pain medicines don't start out with a substance abuse problem. It's the exposure to the medicines that does it. And then, of course, our hearts are deceitful, which, boy, I experienced that. I had a very severe chronic pain problem. I shattered all of the bones in my wrist, and it induced nerve damage. And for the better part of a year, my left arm felt like it was on fire constantly, and it was bright red. It started here and ended here. There was a little white band of I don't know why, skin here. It was a documented nerve problem. And feeling like your arm is on fire all of the time is a horrifying thing to experience. But over time, I started lying is too strong a word, but, you know, jiving myself about how much medicine I needed. It's a common thing to happen when your pain is very severe and you're also in difficult circumstances, which in God's providence was my story. So it's very important to learn how to help your counselees to take their pain medicines for the shortest possible time. Nobody is godly enough for there to be a guarantee that they couldn't become addicted under certain circumstances. And just to tell the end of my story, I finally decided that it was better to have your arm feel like it was on fire than to struggle with some of the things I was struggling with. Stopped taking the medicines prayerfully and said, God, please enable me to endure the pain. And you know what? The darndest thing happened. The pain decreased markedly. I was actually in less pain off all medicines than I was on the medicines that I was taking for the pain. And for the last 7 or 8 years now, the problem has been kept under control by just drugs like Naproxen that don't act on the brain. A wonderful story. Can't count on that happening every time. But as you face people who are struggling with prescription drugs, just understand that few of them set out to become drug addicts. It just requires great understanding and compassion as you try to help people like this. And sooner or later, you'll see them. Okay. Those with painful emotions also often use alcohol to excess and or abuse street drugs. It's self-medication. And alcohol and street drugs hit the same receptors in the brain that pain medicines do. But they produce less pain relief and more relaxation. So they're really kind of designer drugs for people who mainly want to get high, if you will. And that's why they're street drugs. There is no medical use for drugs like those. And because of this, their addictive potential is even greater than that of the pain medicines, because that which the person is seeking after is so very compelling. Alcohol use to excess and street drugs may improve feelings for a while, but they always worsen depression and anxiety in the long run because they produce mental confusion, which makes it harder to think things through. And in addition, if you go to sleep drunk and wake up in the morning, you have experienced a mini alcohol withdrawal. A high level of alcohol in your system, it washes out in the night. And most people wake up feeling a little bit out of sorts. Yes, they have a headache, but they often struggle with anxiety and depression as well. Some of that is regrets for what they've done the night before, but some of it is a real physiological change. So generally speaking, alcohol and street drugs make problems worse in the long run, even if it feels like they're making problems better in the short run. Tranquilizers are drugs that are used for anxiety and to induce sleep. Tranquilizers were developed by drug companies beginning in the 1940s and early 50s specifically to produce relaxation without making you high the way pain medicine, alcohol, and street drugs can. And at first, and you're going to be hearing this over and over again from me, at first they were believed to not be addictive, but in time it was found that they are very habit-forming. See, I told you I'd knock my head mic around sooner or later. I just did it. These drugs include Valium, Xanax, Ativan. There's a jillion of them. There are also new sleeping pills that are supposed to not be habit-forming. In the past, sleeping pills were just a higher dose of the same kinds of drugs that produce tranquilization in lower doses. These new sleeping pills are different, and they're supposed to not be habit-forming like the old ones were. I think it's wise to be suspicious until time proves that claim. And these include drugs like Lunesta, Ambien, and Sonata. Now let's talk about antidepressant drugs. We've talked about the drugs that relax you. Antidepressant drugs, as it turns out, do not induce relaxation. Rather, they induce mild stimulation. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors and norepinephrine serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the so-called SSRIs and NSRIs, are the new generation of antidepressants. There were older agents available. They were superseded completely by Prozac and all of its descendants in the early 80s. I had the opportunity to, excuse me, it was the late 80s, not the early 80s. I had the opportunity to train under the older agents. And of course, the marketing was that these drugs are ever so much better than the older agents. Turns out, as time has gone on, that really hasn't borne out to be true. The idea was that the older agents were supposed to be harder to prescribe, and the newer agents, even a GP could prescribe. And family doctors prescribe them like crazy, indeed. But it turns out they're not any easier to deal with. They have a number of problems that we're going to be talking about in a few minutes. Typically, these medicines, the same drug, antidepressants, are prescribed to counselees who have anxiety and or depression, both and. Tranquilizers are usually prescribed to people who are struggling with anxiety. And for a while, because of the habit-forming potential, psychiatrists weren't prescribing tranquilizers at all. But what happens is fads come and go, and as a new generation of doctors come up that haven't faced some of the problems with tranquilizers, they say, well, maybe these drugs aren't so bad. And we're going through a resurgence now where people are being prescribed tranquilizers again, we can expect as the pendulum swings that we're going to see tranquilizer addicts taking high doses again sooner or later. And I'll be talking a little bit about why that happens when we get into the dependence part of the talk. SSRIs and NSRIs were initially believed not to be habit-forming, but we now know that they are. It took about the same amount of time, typically as 10 to 20 years, before we understand all of the negative effects of a drug. Very important thing for you to understand when a new class of drugs comes out. Typically, people have been tested for 6 to 12 weeks on a medicine that they may end up taking then for many, many years. And so it takes time for all of the side effects and all of the unintended consequences to be discovered. These medicines include Zoloft, Paxil, Prozac, Effexor. That's the one that psychiatrists call side effects. Celexa, Cymbalta. I can't think of the names of some of the new ones, but you've seen the commercials for all of them. They're all related. Antidepressants work by altering chemicals in the brain, relieving the feeling of anxiety and depression. They change feelings, but they don't change the circumstances that, under most circumstances, provoke the feeling. Okay? I'm depressed because my life is depressing, and I'm not responding in a biblical way to my emotional struggles. I feel bad, and I want to take a medicine to take the bad feeling away. And therefore, when the bad feeling becomes better, my feelings are no longer matching my circumstances. There's a disconnect between what's happening to me and the way I respond to it and how I feel. This allows a counselee to ignore circumstances or responses that may need to change. So if I became depressed because my circumstances were terrible, I became depressed because I wasn't trusting in the Lord the way I needed to. I wasn't applying gospel truth to my life in the way that I needed to. And when I take a medicine that allows me to ignore my circumstances and or my responses, I'm doing something that doesn't really make sense, and it's not sustainable in the long run. If my reactions or the circumstances don't change, there's going to be a problem. Common sense just tells you that. Deadening the pain without changing the situation and circumstances does not solve the counselee's problem. So we've been through the drugs that improve feeling section. Now we're going to look at the drugs that clear confused thinking, and there are two types of those, antipsychotic medicines and mood stabilizers. The antipsychotic medicines are prescribed for people who are psychotic. They have serious confusion in their thoughts due to a disease like schizophrenia or Alzheimer's disease. These drugs, commonly prescribed drugs today, include Zyprexa, Risperdal, Seroquel. Those are probably the ones that I see the most. And Abilify, probably the ones that I see advertised the most. And by the way, the drug companies are pushing general practitioners to prescribe antipsychotic drugs. Very serious drugs being prescribed by people who are not expert in their use. I find it troubling. Then there are the mood stabilizing medicines. These are prescribed, well, initially they were prescribed for people who had psychosis that was accompanied by unstable emotions. Classically, we called that manic depression. Today, we call it bipolar disorder type 1, which is separate from bipolar disorder type 2, which is often just referred to as bipolar disorder. I'll be telling you more about that in a minute. That's unstable emotions without psychosis. And it's a brand new disorder, as you'll learn. But the mood stabilizing medicines include an element, lithium, and many anticonvulsants, more all the time. So what is psychosis? Psychosis is diagnosed when people see or hear things that aren't real and believe crazy things. Psychotic symptoms can be faked, but psychotic symptoms almost always are symptoms of a real disease of the brain, not just a chemical imbalance. Now, I mentioned that psychotic symptoms can be faked because Dr. J. Adams, in one of his counseling books in the 70s, talked about psychosis, but all he talked about was a case that he saw when he was training with Maurer, who was the psychologist that he studied under for a brief period of time. He saw one person who was faking. He never said there's no such thing as psychosis. He never said all people diagnosed with psychosis are faking. But there was a movement inside biblical counseling for some years to not believe in the reality of schizophrenia. And that's why I'm pointing this out. Not because I think that if you see a counselee who's been diagnosed with psychosis, that means he or she is faking. Although it's conceivable, it's possible. So if psychotic symptoms are symptoms of a real brain disease, this means that there's something physically wrong with the psychotic person's brain. Diseases that may present with psychotic symptoms include schizophrenia and true bipolar, bipolar type 1, both fairly rare conditions. True bipolar is an excited psychotic state. A person with mood swings without psychosis does not have what I call true bipolar disorder. That's someone who's struggling with their emotions and they swing back and forth. Drug side effects can cause a lot of that, and I'll be talking to you about it in a minute. But it's also true that people can develop a habit of extreme emotional reactions, and I've seen many people with that habit respond to biblical counseling. Alzheimer's disease and other dementias like it that are less well known, but the doctors would know about them, also can present with psychotic symptoms. Traumatic brain injury, it's not well known, but people with traumatic brain injuries often hallucinate sometimes and under certain circumstances. And then there are a host of medical conditions and medicines that can change the brain's health temporarily so that hallucinations occur. And doctors call this delirium. It's being out of touch with reality because you're running a high fever, for example, or because you're in kidney or liver failure. And those are real diseases that have effects on the brain. So let's talk about the effects of antipsychotic drugs. These medicines are given to people with psychosis, but they're also often given to people who are behaving in an uncontrolled way in an attempt to restrain them. And because antipsychotics do restrain behavior and emotions, they've been nicknamed chemical straitjackets. Interestingly, although these medicines really do clear the thinking of people who are truly psychotic, they often cloud the thinking of people who aren't psychotic. What people who aren't psychotic are reacting to is mainly the side effects. And so in the same way that strong pain medicines can cloud the mind, so can an antipsychotic medicine in people who don't really need it. So it can relax someone who's not psychotic, which will make him feel better, but it will definitely blunt his emotional response over time, because remember, the medicines are being given because this person is out of control and needs to come back under control. So it's not a good medicine for people who don't really have psychosis. Antipsychotic medicines can be literally life-saving. Someone who is seriously confused can harm himself or other people, but they can have serious negative effects on those who aren't psychotic. Then there are mood-stabilizing drugs. These calm down people who have psychosis with unstable emotions. Sometimes they're prescribed by themselves. Sometimes they're prescribed along with an antipsychotic medicine. That restores normal eating and sleeping patterns and decreasing excitation. Once again, this can be literally life-saving. A person who's in a true manic psychosis can literally drive himself to exhaustion, not sleeping and not eating. But again, mood-stabilizing drugs can have serious negative effects on people who don't have a true manic psychosis. And these drugs are being prescribed more and more for people who have unstable emotions without psychosis. Let's talk about drug dependence and withdrawal. I am going to be returning to non-psychotic bipolar disorder. I'm not done there, but I need to set the stage for it. So let's talk about drug dependence and withdrawal. Dependence is also known as addiction. It's a physical state which occurs when a person's body has become accustomed to receiving a medicine that has habit-forming potential. Okay, so you become dependent upon it. Your function is no longer normal without it. So one who is dependent upon a medicine will typically require increasing doses of the medicine over time to produce the same effect. And I'll tell you in a minute why that is. Withdrawal is an unpleasant physical reaction that occurs when a person abruptly stops taking a medicine after their body has become accustomed to it. So dependence is the process of becoming accustomed. Withdrawal is what happens if the drug is suddenly cut off after the person has become accustomed to it. The way dependence develops is God has designed us in such a way that when the environment around our body's cell changes, our body will naturally attempt to compensate for the change. So, for example, medicine that slows down your heartbeat will cause your heart to compensate by pumping more blood with each beat. It's an attempt to restore, you remember this word from high school biology, homeostasis, as normal function as possible. Because your body doesn't know the difference between a medicine and a toxin, right? But your body is always going to try to function in the optimal way that is possible based on the physical circumstances it's experiencing. Medicine that changes the chemical environment of the brain will cause the brain to decrease production of its own chemicals, grow new connections between brain cells, or even cause connections that are already there to grow back. All of that is part of your body's effort to maintain homeostasis. And over time, this changed environment becomes the new normal for the body. And your body no longer knows that you're taking the extra serotonin that's caused it to scale back its own production of serotonin. Okay? And of course, this tendency toward homeostasis is one of the reasons why medicines lose effect over time, because the body learns how to compensate to whatever change has occurred. So in withdrawal, your body has become accustomed to the chemical environment around it. It's become the new normal. And withdrawing the medicine suddenly is going to cause your brain to try to compensate for what it perceives as an abnormal event, because it's now seeing having the medicine on board as normal. And unpleasant withdrawal symptoms will occur. And these symptoms will continue until your brain has adjusted to the absence of the medicine. The same process occurs whether you've become dependent upon heroin or your antidepressant, which is not to say that your antidepressant is like heroin. It is so not, and I'm not calling anybody who might be taking medicines today out there a drug addict, but that is the same physiological process. Now, this has been known for quite a while now, but not widely known, because drug companies, in particular in the past, like to refer to withdrawal as a discontinuation syndrome when it occurred on a psychiatric medicine. They prefer the term habituation to dependence. But physiologically, it's the same process as occurs when you become addicted to heroin. It's exactly the same process. So dishonesty on the part of the drug companies led particularly general practice doctors for many years to not understand what was happening when they took someone off of an antidepressant that they'd been on. And they'd say, well, I guess you really do have a disease, because I put you on this medicine for 6 months to help you get over your mother's death, and I can't get you back off of it. You must have a disease. Generally speaking, and this is really important to understand, generally speaking, the symptoms that occur in a withdrawal will be the same symptoms that prompted taking the drug in the first place. Hugely important. An anxious person whose drug is withdrawn from them will become anxious again. So how do you know whether your problem is anxiety or withdrawal? You see the problem. This is what will cause many of your counselees who have tried to stop taking their medicines on their own to believe that they have a disease and they need their medicines for the rest of their lives. Now, when I say helping a counselee stop taking medicines, I am not at all saying that you should tell a person to stop taking their medicines. They should stop taking their drugs only under doctor's supervision, because the medicine needs to be tapered down slowly. But if you are helping someone who has made the decision to stop taking their medicine, these are some things to know. It's essential to understand that your counselee will almost certainly develop withdrawal symptoms if she just stops taking what she's been taking, or he. Medicines often need to be withdrawn very slowly, particularly in people who are anxious. People who are depressed often come off their medicines a little faster, but people who are anxious have a very hard time. There's a book called The Antidepressant Solution by Dr. Joseph Glenn Mullen, who's a Harvard psychiatrist, that is helpful for counselees who want to go off their medicines to read because it can help them to understand it. But once again, I don't recommend that they do it by themselves. If you go see your doctor and say, I want to stop taking it, he will cooperate with you. He will help you taper off. He may not be behind it himself, but he will do it if that's what you want. So urging counselees to stop taking their medicines under a doctor's supervision is absolutely crucial. But reading the book is a helpful adjunct for people to help them to understand what they're going through. Two terms. Poop out is not my term. For years, people have been talking about what they call Prozac poop out, which is the loss of effectiveness of antidepressants over time. And then therapeutic tail chasing, that is my term. They're related to each other, which is why we're going to talk about them together. Poop out refers to the loss of effectiveness. It does occur over time for most people who take antidepressants, and it occurs because they have become dependent. Remember, we know that heroin addicts over time take more and more heroin, right? The reason is that the same dose of heroin no longer produces the same effect because their brain's chemical environment has gotten used to having the drug around, right? Poop out in people who are on antidepressants commonly results in a second and maybe even a third antidepressant being added over time. And the problem is that side effects increase as dosage and number of medicines increase because of poop out. It is predictable. It will happen under most circumstances sooner or later. Not a big issue for you if you're counseling someone who has gone on medicines fairly recently and is participating in biblical counseling. They will feel better, and ultimately they will feel safe with stopping their medicines under control, and they may never experience poop out. But if you get someone who's been on antidepressants for 5 years, almost never are they still only on one antidepressant. Usually they're on several, and often other medicines as well. Therapeutic tail chasing, my term, occurs when side effects or poop out produce new symptoms. A second diagnosis is often given to explain the fact that someone who was doing well is no longer doing well. The doctor is not lying to the patient. That is his understanding. Oh, well, now you have this, or this has emerged. And typically, new medicines, all of which have their own side effects, are added to the medicine that already is giving side effects. And it's not uncommon for those who have been on psychiatric medicine for more than a few years to have several diagnoses and be taking a number of medicines for what may have begun as a simple problem. It's common for doctors to tell a person who develops mood swings on an antidepressant, and that's common because antidepressants are stimulating. In the same way that tranquilizers are chemically related to alcohol, antidepressants, all of these serotonin-related antidepressants are related to, guess what? Cocaine. Meth. That's what they're related to. Okay, they're much, much less strong, and I'm not saying that if you're taking antidepressants, you're taking them to get high. I know you're not. But they are related, okay? So as a result, manic-like reactions are common side effects of antidepressant treatment. And people who develop mood swings on antidepressants are commonly told that they have bipolar disorder type 2, although anymore this distinction between type 1 and type 2 has been disappearing in the medical literature, and they're grouping people who have psychosis and people who've never been crazy in the same bucket when they do effectiveness studies, which obviously is a scientific problem, right? But people who develop mood swings on antidepressants are commonly told that the antidepressant has unmasked their underlying disease, which they always had, of bipolar disorder. And so the mood stabilizer is added, which very conveniently does damp down the mood swings. But what you're doing is you're treating a side effect. You aren't treating a real disease. Dr. Glenn Mullen, the guy who wrote The Antidepressant Solution, he also wrote a book on these side effects of Prozac-like drugs called Prozac Backlash. It's excellent. He said, when people take so much cocaine that they have manic-like reactions and end up in an emergency room, they are diagnosed with cocaine toxicity. When people have manic-like reactions to steroids, they are diagnosed with steroid toxicity. Yet when people have the same types of reactions to antidepressants, they are diagnosed with so-called underlying bipolar disorder. So which psychotropic drugs can produce dependence? Anything that is stimulating. Ritalin is also related to cocaine and methamphetamine, as well as antidepressants. A powerful reason to think twice and think again before placing a child on medicine for ADHD. Now, I don't hold to the position that there's never a circumstance where a child could not benefit from a briefer exposure to a medicine that helps him to pay attention, but the whole idea of you have a disorder that will last the rest of your life is going to be a problem, I think, when people who have always been on Ritalin, and we are now diagnosing adult ADHD and kids diagnosed with it continue on it into adulthood, when they enter the cardiac years, a well-known side effect of stimulants like meth and cocaine is cardiac difficulty. You heard it here first, folks. It's not a sustainable decision to put someone on medicine that improves attention without trying to train the attention. If you want to know more about that, once again, When Good Kids Make Bad Choices has my discussion of these kinds of drugs in children. Okay? So stimulants like Ritalin can produce dependence, so can antidepressants, and so can tranquilizers and the old-fashioned sleeping pills, and maybe, time will tell, the newfangled sleeping pills. Let's talk about antidepressant-induced violence and suicide. The FDA added so-called black box warnings to antidepressant labeling for children in 2004. The warning was that children may become aggressive. A shocking number of school shooters were taking antidepressant medicines when they went on their rampages. Now, some of this is just social contagion. One kid shoots up his school and then another kid shoots up his. And troubled kids are often on drugs. But antidepressant-related violence and suicide is a real issue. And in response to that, the FDA added the black box warning, which is the strongest warning that can be given to a drug that's already on the market. The only more strong action that can be taken is to take the drug off the market. The FDA did not do that, but they added a black box warning to children. And then the FDA recommended that the same warnings be added for adults under age 30 in December of 2006. I have lost track of this issue, but frankly, it makes no sense whatsoever to me to distinguish between a negative effect that occurs in children and one that occurs in adults, and making the dividing line 30 sounds completely arbitrary to me. There have been numerous clinical reports of increased aggression and suicide in adults and children on antidepressants over the years of all ages. This is not common, but it can happen, and you need to know about it if you have even one counselee who's on an antidepressant medicine. Violence and suicide are probably linked to antidepressant side effects, and I learned this from, I'm blanking out on his name, but I quote him in a minute. He also wrote an excellent book. I'm sorry, I can't pull it out of the ether for myself right now. But these were his points. Antidepressant side effects include insomnia, anxiety, and panic attacks. Yes, antidepressants, which are commonly prescribed for anxiety, can also produce it as a side effect. It's a stimulant. Stimulants make people anxious. Anybody who's ever met a speed freak knows that. Akathisia, which is an almost intolerable sensation of internal restlessness, sometimes accompanied by mental turmoil. People decide that they want to kill themselves because they are experiencing this intolerable internal feeling. I believe that's what happened to me when I suddenly wanted to violently kill myself 5 days after having yet another stimulating medicine added to my drug cocktail. Other side effects? Mania, irritability, hostility, and impulsivity. The kind of thing that causes a man who's been mild-mannered all of his life to pick up his gun and pull the trigger without even thinking about it. Paranoia and psychosis. Now, I am not telling you don't ever recommend that someone take an antidepressant and recommend immediately that they go off of it because these bad things might happen to them. we have to weigh the benefits and the risks, and under certain circumstances, there could be a benefit to their being on the medicine, particularly for a short time. But let's not anyone underestimate the power of these drugs. They are very serious drugs. Here he is, Dr. Anthony Healy. He was, for a time, the head of the British equivalent of our FDA, quite a respected person. When he started speaking out about the effects of antidepressants, he was shunned and marginalized in his profession, and he wrote a very angry book, Let Them Eat Prozac, in response. But it's a real eye-opener in terms of the kinds of problems that it revealed. It said a lot about his expert witnessing on these effects in trials against drug companies. So it's a bit of a polemic, but it contains a great deal of scientific information if you should decide you want to read it. He said, those experiencing these highly unpleasant symptoms, if they don't know that they're caused by their medicines, often conclude that they are going insane. The accompanying impulsivity greatly increases the risk that the sufferer will take action on the feeling by becoming violent to themselves or others. He tells a story of he and a group of other researchers deciding that some of them would take antidepressant medicines so that they themselves already presumably mentally healthy, not experiencing any distress, so that they would understand better what are the effects that happen specifically to people who are depressed and what are the effects that happen to other kinds of people. Well, what happened was pretty shocking. A couple of the people who were taking the medicines, and these were previously stable people who'd never had any emotional difficulties, became shockingly careless and aggressive. One woman was convinced that a group of young men standing on a corner in a bad neighborhood were talking about her, got out of the car and confronted them aggressively. Another one struggled with the overpowering desire to hang herself. Now, you know what? Women never hang themselves. They never jump off bridges either. But I know of at least one woman, a godly pastor's wife, who within a couple of weeks of starting on an antidepressant, drove 6 hours to find a bridge to jump off of. And this woman, who had never had emotional difficulty before, was suddenly struggling with the desire to hang herself. Women don't do that. So I'm not telling you these things to tell you antidepressants are bad, don't have anything to do with them, but rather so that you can know as counselors that in a circumstance like this, the medicine is the problem. Okay? It's rare, but it happens. Side effects. I'm going to whiz right through this because I don't expect you to remember all of it. It would not be helpful. But let's talk about them really quickly. Tranquilizers and sleeping pills, very high addictive potential. They can cause the same kind of liver disease that heavy drinking produces. They commonly produce mental confusion and drowsiness. The mental confusion can increase anxiety, which is what they're being given to treat. They can produce memory problems and slow reaction time, like what alcohol does. They can produce depression, weakness, dizziness, problems with coordination. Many old people who fall down and break a hip are taking something to sleep. Now, I'm not saying that under no circumstances should an old person take medicine to sleep, but we need to understand the potential for difficulty, increased potential for falls and injuries. Side effects of stimulants and antidepressants, dependence and withdrawal, anxiety, panic attacks, seizures, mania, psychosis, tics, including Tourette's syndrome, nervousness, insomnia, irritability, and aggression. We've already talked about those. More stimulant side effects. They stunt the growth of children. That's why typically they take kids who are on ADHD drugs off for the summertime. They increase heart rate. They increase blood pressure. This is why I say be concerned about what happens to people as they reach the cardiac years, having been on these medicines all their lives. They can cause heart and liver failure, sudden death from heart arrhythmia or stroke. More side effects. What psychiatrists call extrapyramidal symptoms, akathisia, I told you already about the internal restlessness, dyskinesia, involuntary body movements, like this, uncontrollable, dystonia, involuntary muscle spasms, drug-induced Parkinson's disease, Tardive dyskinesia is a potentially permanent set of abnormal body movements. They're rare, but they can happen with antidepressants. More antidepressant side effects. Poor appetite at the beginning of treatment, followed by weight gain of 20 pounds or more, producing massive obesity in some cases. Loss of sexual desire is very common. Birth defects in some children of some mothers on antidepressants, and withdrawal in newborns of mothers who are on antidepressants. Please note that this means that they are born dependent on the medicine. Psychiatrists used to say you should go off the medicines if you're going to get pregnant. They aren't saying that anymore. They're saying that the benefit of being on the antidepressant outweighs the risk, which is small, relatively speaking. But would you want your wife or yourself to be pregnant on a medicine that could cause an effect like this in anybody? Let's talk about side effects of antipsychotic medicines. There are two groups of antipsychotic medicines, older drugs and the ones that are newer. Haldol is the most typical of the old ones, Zyprexa of the new ones. The older medicines had a very high rate of extrapyramidal syndrome and tardive dyskinesia. The newer medicines are much less likely to cause it, but they can. It's an important thing to know. One of the reasons why I don't like to hear about general practitioners adding Abilify to someone's antidepressant medicine. Other side effects, uncontrolled and potentially massive weight gain over time, producing in many cases what the drugs call metabolic, what the doctors call metabolic syndrome, which is diabetes and heart disease, as well as obesity, linked to the increased weight. Neuroleptic malignant syndrome, which is a rare but potentially life-threatening complication. Seizures, low blood pressure, fainting, sleepiness, liver failure, changes to the menstrual cycle, potentially dangerous inability to tolerate hot weather. Side effects of mood-stabilizing medicines. Lithium can produce extrapyramidal syndrome, shaking, confusion, mental slowing, and memory problems. Kidney failure, very serious problem with lithium. It's a drug with a very narrow therapeutic window, so you can go toxic on it at a dose that's not much higher than the therapeutic dose. Serious. Heart trouble, liver trouble, hair loss, fairly common on lithium, weight gain and acne. Anticonvulsants, the other thing that are used for mood stabilizing, they're the medicines that are used to treat epilepsy. Everyone would agree that the risk is worth the benefit to keep people from dying in a seizure that won't stop or having brain damage and living. It's also a worthwhile drug to give to someone who's psychotic, but routine prescription of antipsychotics and mood stabilizers to people who don't really have these kinds of devastating physical problems is a problem. Side effects of anticonvulsants, life-threatening liver disease and pancreatitis, low blood platelet levels, bone marrow depression in one of them, Tegretol. Lamictal is linked to two potentially fatal diseases. Depakote can produce birth defects to the extent that they don't want women on Depakote to become pregnant under any circumstances. Nausea, sleepiness, dizziness, weakness. Now, I'm not running through that laundry list to persuade you that your counselees should never take these medicines, but that your counselees should have very serious problems that are not addressable any other way before they consider taking these problems. There are people who will have real diseases of the brain who need to accept that risk. But how very important it is to decide to learn from painful emotions rather than go the medicine route given the potentially devastating effects of all of these medicines. I'm going to stop here. The rest of it is repetition of what I gave you just in the last hour. Once again, these presentations don't always occur together. So I am going to stop here, and let us take a 10-minute break. If you will be back here at 3:10, we'll pick up with our third lecture. Thank you very much.